We are going to get an update on the state of dairy in Minnesota. We had a little bit of discussion about that last week. We also later on are going to hear some bonding bills. But we do appreciate that Minnesota Milk Producers Association Dairy Day is here and that they've provided some treats. And we also want to recognize that we may have some Minnesota Farm Bureau presidents or others in the audience, because today is their Council of County Presidents reception this afternoon at the History Center. So you can go from Minnesota Milk reception to Minnesota Farm Bureau reception and have lots of activity this afternoon. So welcome. I know that we have Mr. Buck and Mr. Sjostrom to begin with, so we welcome you to the committee. And I think, I don't know who's going to begin, but okay. So welcome to the committee, Mr. Buck.
Thank you, Madam Chair Poppy, and members of the committee. Thank you for having us here today. My name is David Buck. I'm a dairy farmer from Goodhue, currently serving as president of the Minnesota Milk Producers Association. Basically been dairy farming since the day I was born. I was off the farm for a year. I went to college, and then the way things worked out, I ended up having to come home and farm full time, which was a-okay with me. We have six children. Two are directly involved in the farm. One does a custom manure pumping and silage harvesting business. So he gets involved with a lot of different other dairy farmers with that. First on the agenda, I'd like to just thank you for the dairy program that you passed last year. We got an $8 million rebate that helped cover the cost of the federal government through their dairy margin coverage program. We did lose a lot of dairy farmers last year, 330 roughly. I think without that help, it would have been worse. There's no two ways about it. 2018 was a tough year in the dairy industry. The bill led by Representative Poppy and with help from Senator Westrum, as well as Speaker Hortman and Leader Gazelka and the governor's office, allowed Minnesota to lead the nation in percentage. They're one of the leading ones. We were 89.5% of dairy farmers signed up for the program. So we certainly want to thank the Department of Agriculture and under Tom Peterson and the USDA Farm Agency under Joe Martin, excuse me, for the work they did in implementing the program. I've been obviously farming for a long time. I think that was the smoothest introduction of any farm program that I've ever seen. You walked into the FSA office, they had the information, and it was just very well done. That was one of the reasons, the main reasons we actually awarded our first ever Policymakers of the Year awards to those two for their help in implementing that program. Milk prices started to improve in November, which for many people was probably the first profitable month they've had in quite a few people, several years. Going forward, and milk prices look okay. I think I'd liken it to everybody finally got their head above their head above water, and now we're just trying to catch our breath, a lot of us. And some, I think going forward, there will be more reinvestment in the dairy industry in Minnesota. One of our issues is the Section 179 conformity. It gets to be an issue, and it's complicated, the tax issue, but basically there, you could be put in a position where you will pay income tax to the state of Minnesota on money that you never made. It sounds crazy, but that's, it happened. Although we support the full $1 million, we would be happy with anything. And I'll give you an example. So if you trade in a tractor that's worth $70,000 and you buy a tractor that's worth $150,000, on your income, state income tax, you show an income of $70,000, and then you are not allowed to depreciate the tractor you bought. as quickly as the federal. So in effect, you are paying income tax on money that technically you did not receive. You just did a like-kind exchange. So that's the crux of the matter, I think. Livestock investment grants, they are a huge thing for us, especially in our industry. We're a capital-intensive industry. And most of these grants go to farms that are modernizing, looking at the next generation. Recently, they've been targeted towards things like robotics and things like that. So it's targeted towards people that are trying to be around here for the long haul. And we want to continue to do that. The health insurance issue really hasn't gone away, especially in southeast Minnesota. I'm not sure how you solve that problem. I think I've spoken with Chair Poppy several times, and I think she understands the issues, and we're looking forward to something helping in that area. Broadband internet is a need on today's farms. It's the technology we have evolving with robotics, activity monitors, which are like Fitbits for cows. We have a little thing we put in their ear, and I can go to the computer the next there every morning. I go in there and you log in, and this cow, there's something wrong with her. You can tell that she's either very active or not active. Not active is they're sick or something's wrong, and you have to go figure that out. So you need that broadband technology to access that information. The other issue in infrastructure, roads and bridges, you know, moving our product to market and bringing in the raw products that we use is always critical. So we certainly want to maintain our roads and bridges and improve them. Finally, there's a lot of talk about climate change or our, I guess, effect on the climate. And I think cows in general, or the dairy industry in general, has lowered their carbon footprint. I think it's roughly 40% over the last 30 years. So we're just more efficient than we were before. And I think we're actually leading the world in that department. MPCA has started to recognize that alfalfa can capture carbon, and I think that's a huge thing. So many times we hear about the carbon footprint of say the dairy industry. What you don't hear is the crops we grow and how they pull the carbon out of the atmosphere. And we just have a very sustainable cycle, and especially in the dairy industry. Cows, you know, the cows feed us and the land feeds the cows. It's a never-ending cycle. And I think that's a huge plus for the dairy industry. Methane digesters are something that's been tried. We have on a small percentage of dairy farms. Actually, you take manure and you put it in a digester. It creates methane. You burn that, and it use it to make electricity. So that's another way that the dairy industry is decreasing their carbon footprint. So does anybody have any questions they'd like to ask? Or
thank you, Mr. Buck. Yes, we do have a question. Representative Eklund.
Try to fix this microphone first. Maybe it doesn't work. I'll talk loudly. You mentioned broadband internet is critical to your operations. Do the milk producers belong to the Rural Broadband Coalition? And you can get back to me on that. It's just a coalition that's pushed hard to get broadband funding. So, I mean, it might be an organization for you guys to take a look at joining.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Buck, for your work and for your testimony. My question is about the 330 farms, dairy farmers that were lost this last year. Can you tell us a little bit more about those farms? Are there trends about the types of farms, the size of farms, Anything that you can pull out of that number that would be helpful for us to know?
So, Mr. Buck?
Madam Chair, I think last year was maybe a little different than what we'd been seeing. There's always been a consolidation in the dairy industry. It's just been ongoing since I started. I think we've lost 85% of the dairy farms since I started farming in the late 70s, early 80s. But last year was a little different. We had kind of a perfect storm. Historically, it's been the smaller operators that were ending, but we had some barn collapses last year that affected some people, and that was, I would say, a driving force on, you know, one of my neighbors. They were 300 cow operation, and literally their barn collapsed at 6:30 at night, and the cows were gone by 7 o'clock the next morning. And so you had them situations. Also just the economics, and that was affected all sizes also. It wasn't, I can name a 500 cow, a 900 cow, a 90 cow, a 40 cow, all within 10 minutes of my place that went out of business. And I think economics was the major factor in that. But I guess it's larger farms were going out of business this time at a greater rate, I think, than what they had in the past. And that, I think, is basically the economics of it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you said that the prices are better this year than they were in the past, the challenges that have economically that have come to you as an industry, along with the fact of the loss of buildings and the herd itself, can you kind of explain, it doesn't flip in just one year of good prices. How long does it take you to recover the damages and the challenges that would face a dairy farmer?
Mr. Buck.
Madam Chair and committee, I think every situation is a little different. Obviously, some could see that there was no way to get out of the current economic situation. Historically, we talk about the three-year cycle in dairy. It's 1 year's good, 1 year's break-even, 1 year's not good. And the difference this time, I think the three-year cycle was still there. It was just at a much lower plateau, and that was the issue. You know, that to your question, that might be better asked of a banker or a loan officer that sees a lot more operations than what I see. But, you know, it's I think it's going to take some time. I do, before you see widespread prosperity. But you know, we've turned the corner, and hopefully it continues to get better.
Thank you. Last week we had a question about the percentage of farmers that participated in the Dairy with an Eye program, and I think you mentioned that. Was it, you just, Mr. Shostrom, you want to answer that?
Yes, thank you. Madam Chair, committee, as Dave said, we had 89.5% enrollment, so we were behind three generally non-dairy states. I think it was Puerto Rico, New Mexico, and Mississippi or something like that. So we were the highest out of the whole country of enrolling in the federal program. And then at the state level specifically, Department of Agriculture can correct me, but the latest numbers I have seen were, and I think this was shared with you last week, about 1,600 farms and 1,800 producers enrolled. And that's out of about 2,500 farms we have right now, a little less than 2,500. So depending on which percentage you want to look at, about 90 or 80 or 70%, which is, I think, phenomenal, as Dave said, compared to what I think we would have had had we not done this program.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Chair Poppe. Mr. Buck, thanks for being here. If I could ask a question on kind of the next layer up, processing in Minnesota. We've heard that Dean Foods, for example, of bankruptcy. Has that affected Minnesota dairy farmers, and both in terms of fluid milk and the cheese processing? Are we at capacity in processing here in Minnesota?
Mr. Buck?
Madam Chair and committee, I'm not sure I can answer that totally, but we're in a, the worst spot was 2 years ago as far as processing. The issue with Dean Foods, and I think Borden also filed, they were so heavily into the fluid market, and that's been probably the most challenging area in the dairy industry is the fluid milk market. Cheese, yogurt, their other solid products, I'll call them, have done better the last 10 years than the fluid. So that's part of the equation there. There's ongoing improvements in the dairy processing. You know, plants are making increasing capacity in that, but the fluid market is really in flux right now with those two players maybe not being involved. So I'm not sure where that'll take us. I don't know if Lucas has anything to add to that.
Mr. Shostrom.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'll be brief, as I always am. Lucas Shostrom, for the record, by the way, Executive Director at Minnesota Milk. DFA signed a partial purchase agreement for some of Dean Foods' assets yesterday. The Woodbury Dean Foods plant is not involved in that. And I guess the simple answer to your question, which there isn't one, is it all will affect dairy farms in Minnesota, even if it was just happening in Florida or Texas or California. The way our milk price works, we can, because we're so efficient here, we can get milk from Minnesota to Florida overnight if we need to, and they could have fresh Minnesota milk on their table in 48 hours. So it all does affect Minnesota in some way, shape, or form. About 16% of our milk here in Minnesota is made into fluid. So as Dave said, we are a little muted because so much of our market's derived from the cheese and butter markets and their derivatives.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers. Could you just speak briefly to Minnesota's regulatory requirements and or fees to operate? Are they competitive with other states? If you could just speak to that a little bit.
Mr. Buck.
I think I'll defer to Lucas on
this one. Mr. Shostrom, very good.
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, you have, through previous versions of this committee, seen the 2015 report from the Department of Agriculture on the fee differences. I don't think those fees have changed much, and we are basically higher in every category. There's currently a proposal from the Pollution Control Agency through the rulemaking process to increase fees on every farm in the state with more than 7 cows, which has caused some alarms. Further on top of that is it would force the county feedlot officers to collect the money, even in the delegated counties where the MPCA is not doing the majority of the work. So that's concerning and one thing going on right now, Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton. Overall, I think uncertainty and a lack of streamlining is our biggest concern that I hear from our membership as people are going through a permitting process. We've now added federal and state and county and sometimes township requirements on top of that. And they're all, I don't think any dairy farmer, because of the sustainability practices that President Buck talked about earlier, I don't think we're afraid of the requirements. I think it's the process and streamlining that with the benefit of the environment in mind. That's where I think we can get and where I think all sides can come to agreement on. But I think there's people and groups that simply don't want dairy farms here, and so those obstacles are put purposefully, not for the betterment of the environment, but to stop dairy farms from existing. And people often think, oh, that's to stop large farms from happening, and that might be true in their intent, but typically all of those regulations and rules are plucked and said, you know, as a smaller farm per se, or a farm with less than 1,000 animal units is the cutoff that we use today. Why don't you guys adhere to some of these requirements, some form of permitting? And that's where it gets really hard for, I think, a smaller dairy farm, if you want to call it that, to get through the process.
Thank you. All right, and we have Representative Brand.
Madam Chair. Lucas, I just had a quick question for you. Last year, you had a great presentation. You talked about the future of dairy in Minnesota. Where are we a year later?
Mr. Shostrom.
Madam Chair, Representative Brand, I would say I don't want to speak for President Buck, but in the back of our minds is those 330 people who we lost and all the others on the edge. So that's really difficult. And I think every dairy farmer is optimistic because they want their neighbors to succeed. But if you can and this isn't a zero-sum game, but if you can eliminate the negative thoughts, which is very hard to do, especially in the times we've been through, I think there's a lot of renewed optimism out there. The fact of the matter is the cost of production you need to compete at has dropped. But I've received more calls and heard more innovative things in the past 12 months than I heard in my first 4 years here, my first 3 years here. So people are looking for ways to do things different, which I think is really great. But, it's going to be a partnership of the state of Minnesota, our cooperatives and processors and our dairy farms all saying, how can we be innovative and beat this thing in the long run if we're going to succeed? So I would say that's where things are. They're very much in the same state that they were last year, but I think people are, they've been challenged enough, dairy farmers have been challenged enough that they know they're probably going to need to change their operations. And most of us here are member owners of cooperatives. And so therefore you might pull up and you see a red barn and a silo or a freestall barn and a feed pad, but we're also owners of that processing, which is very unique compared to many other industries.
Thank you. And we are going to then go on, Mr. Sjostrom, and thank you, Mr. Buck, for the testimony. You're going to maybe talk about the Dairy Producer of the Year.
Thank you for the time before the committee. Right now I'd like to introduce Fran Myron of Myron Farms from Hugo. He was one of the family members of our Minnesota Milk Producer of the Year family. Their family excels at caring for cows and land, being good neighbors, and passing on to the next generation. You also may see him wearing one of his other hats. He's a Washington County Commissioner and former mayor of Hugo, currently serves on Minnesota Farm Bureau Board of Directors. And I'm not sure how he gets it all done, but we have a video featuring his farm, and you can ask him questions after that.
Thank you,
Greg.
Thank you.
I'm fourth generation of our family here on the farm. Marianne is first generation of her family here on the farm.
He usually gave me the job of going down to the woods at 5 a.m. to round up the cows in the dark and bring them up pasture. But
well, we had to break the city girl in quick.
So I helped milk and stuff. But as the kids got older, then they kind of replaced me. He didn't really like my tractor driving that much anyway.
Well, you did fine. You just weren't used to the hills. It was just really a blessing raising our kids on the farm where we could teach the same values we grew up with, but also have the grandparents so close by to reinforce and help instill those values in our kids.
I know I enjoyed my childhood, and I'm happy that I hope to give my kids, or in this one so far, hopefully there'll be more, but I hope to give them the same opportunities that I had.
I mean, it took a little bit for Josie to warm up, but she loves animals too, just as much as James, and Joy sees that from her siblings, so I'm sure she'll be the same way. And James, you know, when he was here during the summer, he wakes up and he comes over, you come into the house, well, what are we doing today, Dad? What do we got to do today, you know?
We just did a breakfast on the farm. It had been 4 years since we had done one. I really think that that helps us maintain our relationship with our neighbors.
Education in itself is a big part of our family, and we do a lot of farm tours and try to educate the consumers because, you know, the consumers is what drives our business.
Our farm is located just 18 miles north of St. Paul, Minnesota, so a very, very metropolitan area. I served on the city council. I actually was first elected back in 1989 and served as mayor for 16 years. Had 20 years in city government. I really think that over the years, we did a good job on the city council, identifying the needs of rural people, the agricultural needs within the area, so that we could meet those needs and still allow for growth and development. When I first got on the city council, our population in Hugo was 3,000 people, and we're now around 16,000.
Farming, I think, is not just a job, it's more of a way of life, and it's You know, the land isn't something that you just buy and sell. I mean, it's got a totally different significance in your life than what most people feel about, you know, they buy a house and sell a house, and you know, it's just totally different. The land is your livelihood, and there's something unique and very special about that.
Thank you. Welcome.
Morning, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. And it's those family members that are at home still doing the work after an evening of snow that has allowed me to be here this morning. So, but appreciate the opportunity and certainly open to any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Do we have questions? Certainly we have congratulations from the entire committee. We are always appreciate hearing about successes and, you know, the value of, you know, family and farming and what that means to you and your family. And I would agree with Mr. Buck that it's hard to believe you have time to actually farm when you're doing all this other stuff. So we appreciate that you even took the time today to be able to be here. But I think I don't see any. Yeah, Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. Question for Mr. Shostrom. Lucas, I read a while back, about a month ago, that kind of a big day in Wisconsin where their Farm Bureau and Farmers Union agreed to at least advocate for a study of supply management. Where are we at with that in Minnesota? Has it been talked about, or what are the feelings on some kind of a supply management program here in Minnesota?
Good question. Mr. Shostrom.
Yeah, great question, Madam Chair. Mr. Anderson, Representative Anderson, it's. I don't know if the pedal has ever come off it being talked about. I would say it's very polar. At Minnesota Milk, we still stand as a mostly state-focused organization. We have our cooperatives as members that lead us at the federal level. So we are totally supportive of cooperative-level supply management. They're able to do that today as they so choose. We're open to federal supply management, but as I said, it's a very polar environment in that. So there are meetings going on, but as we focus typically on state policy, we mostly allow our co-ops to lead us on the federal and don't have a firm stance for or against at this point.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Myron, thinking about production or processing, and as an individual farm, have you ever thought of moving into the processing side of it with cheese or butter? What are impediments for individual farmers on actual taking it from just producing the milk, but actually producing a retail product? If you've got folks that are coming to the farm and visiting, have you thought about actual retail at the site?
Mr. Miron.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, we have not personally, but I can share with you, Autumnwood Farm is just up the road from us a few miles, and they did get involved in that type of an operation, creating a micro creamery on their farm. One of the problems we see and we have within the industry is just the massive man hours it takes to operate a dairy farm. So we've got about 350 head of livestock on our farm. We're milking 125 cows right now. The two boys that you saw in the video have both been with us. Andrew graduated from the University of Minnesota 4 years ago and came back to the farm after receiving his degree in animal science. Actually had a double major in animal science and ag education. Paul's been with us for about 14 years. He had gone to school at Wisconsin Indian Head Technical College and came back to the farm after graduating from his college experience. Those guys work 16-hour days, and their day off, you know, Sunday is their day off, and that's typically an 8 to 9 hour day just to get the work and the chores done. And I'm there as much as I can be, but starting a second business really on the farm is what you're talking about, requires significant capital, it requires significant time and management. And those oftentimes are the factors that come to play. As Mr. Solstrom indicated earlier, we are members of a cooperative creamery that processes our milk, and we've been members of that creamery actually since 1978. So we have ownership there and participate in activities, annual meetings, and providing direction to the board of managers and the chief operating officer of that facility. So in some ways, we do manage our production. It's just not production on the farm. But I think really time and capital are the significant issues related to that and developing a market. And I can share with you a number of farms that I know that got involved in that type of processing activity and are no longer in the dairy business today. So, you know, if I may, Madam Chair, as we talk about incomes, and I sent a text message to a friend of ours that's a farm business management instructor, actually went to school with one of my older sons who's an ag teacher in Forest Lake School District and advises the FFA group there. I asked her what the average cost of production was in their farm management organization, and for 2018, which was the most recent that she could give me, that cost of production was $15.67 to $16.80 per hundredweight. Our last milk check, which we received here on the 16th of February, was $15.80 per hundred was the base price. Now, with premiums, because the boys are doing a good job feeding for components, breeding for components, and also with their quality incentives, they're receiving a little over $18 a hundred for their milk. But, you know, still, that's not a very high profit margin when you consider the amount of labor and capital investment that goes into that operation. You saw pictures of our farm. Both the boys had applied for livestock investment grants, which they received two rounds of grants. So some of the improvements that you see on the farm there are a result of those livestock investment grants. Thank you for that. They have taken over much investment in the farm, and the livestock investment grants have helped significantly with that. And again, to the Section 179 that Mr. Buck mentioned earlier, that comes to play even with young farmers entering a farm operation like that and establishing themselves, you know, as they invest their own capital into that. So we appreciate the opportunity. Little James that you saw in the film there, Paul's oldest son, was at the farm yesterday because it was President's Day. He didn't have his preschool in session, and he took a nap up in the bedroom of our house. He's the sixth generation to sleep in that bedroom on our house, and we appreciate the fact that both of the boys and our entire family, our six adult children and their wives and spouses and families, all still enjoy the farm and are involved in agriculture in some way.
Thank you. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I applaud you for doing the breakfast on the farm thing, and the reason I'm saying this is because if your population growth in the Hugo area was up to 16,000 people, I'm just wondering if the new people moving in are have different ideas about farming and if you're starting to feel any kind of a NIMBY type thing happen.
Mr. Muran.
Madam Chair, Representative, you know, we had a little over 2,000 people attend that breakfast on the farm, and we thank all of our sponsors because it it took about, I think it was a little over $9,000. My wife did the bookkeeping on it to put that breakfast on. And that didn't count the sweat and the hard work just to get the farm ready and some extra lime rock in the driveway and that type of thing. But and so we did have some sponsors, but that does go a long way in building trust among the people, the consumers that buy our products. Certainly creates an opportunity for our neighbors to see what we're doing and understand more fully what we're doing. And we do that on a regular basis. And each year we have schools that call, and we provide tours for young students. Four of our adult children are teachers. Three of them teach agriculture. One teaches elementary school. My major from the University of Minnesota was in ag education. I chose to come back to the farm. But certainly education is a key component of our makeup, and trying to help people understand our lifestyle and what we do. You know, there was some recent criticism about dairy farmers and the fact that, you know, we're producing milk beyond what the baby calf will drink, and I won't apologize for that. We're very efficient in what we do, but that allows all of the rest of you that aren't involved in dairy or some form of agriculture really to go about your own pursuits without the worry of where your food is going to come from. And I think that's important. And there was also criticism about the use of artificial insemination. And, you know, quite honestly, unless you've been the victim of a Holstein bull and felt the pressure of his head against your body as he grinds you into the ground, you don't understand the value of safety as it relates to artificial insemination and not having that animal, that mature Holstein bull on the farm. And I tell you, every year we see incidents, we read incidences of our fellow dairymen who have lost their lives, you know, because of the safety issues related around a male animal on the farm. And so, you know, we use our best science and best technology available to make sure that we produce wholesome and healthy products, and that our children, James in this case, remain safe on that farm. My father lost his arm in a farm accident when he was 33. A year later, his brother lost his life on our farm, and we try to avoid that to the extent that we can.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for those sobering reminders that farming is not the safest endeavor. So appreciate that you came today through the snow, and that you were able to, and it's very clear to see why you're the Dairy Producer of the Year. You're very strong advocate for your industry, and thank you for being here today. And thank you, Mr. Sjostrom, Mr. Buck, for also providing the information. We're going to move on, but appreciate that. And I have to apologize to the sugar growers in the audience, and maybe they have now left, unfortunately. But Representative Keel reminded me that they are here today. They also have a reception, I believe, this afternoon. So, again, people will be traveling here and there and everywhere, but I think they're all at the Capitol Ridge, or a couple of them are.
Yes, they are.
Next door. So yes. The sugar growers are there, as well as the, I think, the Minnesota Dairy.
Dairy,
yeah.
Cooperatives.
And the cooperatives? Okay.
Yeah.
My gosh.
Both of those are cooperatives.
So. Oh, yes. Yes. Got it. So thank you. And I apologize, Representative Keel, that I missed that. So please let them know that we did not intend to leave them out. But next we're going to talk about RFA. We will have a bill, and the bill that we have is actually with the bonding committee, but we are having an informational hearing on that. So this is part of that. So we want to make sure that we understand RFA and the need for it. And so as our committee administrator gets everything set up, certainly we know that this is a very successful program, and the issue that we have right now is that they're running low on funds, and so we wanted to be able to hear about the Rural Finance Authority, the program that they provide, and then be able to hopefully get that bill through bonding. But we won't need to act on that. But there is some information in the packet. I think we have the PowerPoint in the packet, but we're going to go ahead, and if you'll just state your name for the record, and then you may begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Representative. My name is Matt McDevitt. I am the Ag Finance Supervisor for the Rural Finance Authority. So I have a presentation for you today. It's not real long and not nearly as entertaining as the farm one, but I will go ahead with that and kind of give you brief overview of the Rural Finance Authority, kind of where we sit today and what we've been up to. So the Rural Finance Authority currently has about $578,000 worth of loan funds to lend out to Minnesota farmers. So we are definitely running a little low. We expect that to be at or near zero as soon as this week, maybe next week. So just about out. The RFA does prioritize loans, certain types, especially beginning farmer loans, as we, you know, part of our mission is to really help people get into the industry and start out when it's the toughest to do so. So we have about $1 million worth of lower priority loans that we kind of have on the shelf. We do kind of a conditional approval and just tell the banks, well, if we're able to get some authorization for bonding, then we will approve those first, but they're approved conditionally pending some money coming forth. A little overview of different bonding amounts we've had all the way back to 86. You'll see the last three, four have been kind of the 35 to 33 million range. So that typically used to be good for somewhere around 3 to 4 years back in like 2009, 2012. But recently we are lending out somewhere in the area of about 22 to 25 million a year. So those previous amounts are a little bit short of what would able to be pulled us over for a couple of years. RFA does have a very strong record of success. Through December 31st here of 2019, we've issued over 3,094 loans for $289 million. Loan losses on that amount of loans have been $555,000 on 21 loans since 86. So we've done a pretty good job of keeping charge-offs from occurring. That represent about 0.2%, so that's pretty low. Our current outstanding loan balance is about $94.4 million. That represents 626 active files. We like to remind that the program is user financed, so any authorization we get for bonding, we take that money and we lend it out and pay it back with interest. So this is not money that's just out the door. It's money that comes in and then comes back to the state. And with that low loss ratio, the slightly higher interest we charge on the loans as compared to what we sell them for is more than offset. So last September we did sold $15 million worth of taxable bonds. We also did another $4.5 million of non-taxable at 2.15%. So that's a great rate in which to sell at, because then we were able to pass on the lower interest rates to our beginning farmers and other farmers that apply for and qualify for our loans. So we didn't get authority to sell anymore last year, which potentially, depending on the interest rate environment at the next sale, could potentially mean we have to charge more for loans in the future, but that's, I never know how that's going to work out. So we typically do bond sales in August or August of the year, so our second or third week.
Thank you.
That completes my presentation. So.
All right. Thank you for the presentation. And just as a reminder, 2959 is the House File 2959. I think the majority of committee members have signed on to that bill. It's one that actually is in the bonding committee and will be heard there. But Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McDevitt, just a quick question. There's been quite an acceleration in the last couple of years of use of this program. Is there like kind of a blanket reason for that, or is it a series of reasons, or I'm just curious as to kind of what's seen this pretty significant uptick.
Mr. McDevitt.
Madam Chair, Representative Miller. You know, there's probably a few reasons. One is that part of it is our program is just better known. It gets talked about a little bit more. People are more aware of it. Times have been tough as well. So with our lower interest rate, it allows the loans to cash flow a little bit better and allows more people to qualify for loans that might not normally otherwise. The banks have become a little more risk averse, you know, for apparent reasons over the last few years. So the fact that we take a chunk of their loans, So for those of you maybe that don't know, if we were doing, say, you know, for illustration purposes, $100,000 loan, the bank would loan the farmer $55,000 of it, and we would borrow them $45,000 of it. So we our lower interest rates, which is usually somewhere between 1.5 to 2 or so percent less, helps the loan cash flow better, and then also removes some of the risk from the bank, so they're more willing to provide these types of loans where they might not otherwise.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One quick follow-up question, if I could. Could you get me kind of like a list of the, of, I know I can't see the individual loans, I get that, but a breakdown of where the loans have gone over this past year or two. If I could get a list of that, that would be great.
I'd be,
Mr. McNair,
Representative, I'd be happy to forward that to you.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we have a couple more people on the list here. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm following up on a question I asked the Commissioner of Ag a couple meetings ago. And are the RFA loans available for, let's say, installing solar on agricultural buildings? Are the any of the solar activities on installation or hookup, are those eligible expenses?
Mr. McDevitt.
Madam Chair, Representative. Yes, we do have a couple of different programs that could potentially be used in that sense and have been used that way before. So we have one of our revolving account loans, which that account is loans as the money's paid back. We're able to re-lend that out. So farm opportunity, that can be used for solar, as well as some of our ag improvement could potentially be used in that sense as well. We also have administered the Ag BMP program, agricultural best management program, and that one actually gets used probably more than most for those types of projects. It ends up even being a little bit better deal in many cases. So we have a few different avenues.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This may be a question directed more to you. It was surprising to learn that they may be out of money by next week or the week after, and bonding bills can tend to wind up at the end of session and be rocky at best. Any chance of moving this along as a separate bill and getting this done sooner?
I hope there's a chance. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Yes, we are working on that, trying to see if that can happen. You know, it's different. The RFA bonding is different than the other bonding. As we know, we all have to craft that, the big bonding bill, to make sure that we have bipartisan support, because you need to have the supermajority to be able to pass that. RFA does not have that same requirement. So it's just a simple majority. So we're able to, and we have done that in the past. You never know. Political challenges can always exist, but you know, we have been speaking with leadership to encourage that. And so hopefully that would be a possibility. Yes.
I think we'd all support that, so good luck.
Yeah, thank you. Well, you know, leadership is, you know, on all sides of the aisle, so we can make sure that we're kind of hoping to see that happen. But thank you. Thanks for asking. You know, this is, again, just so we know, House File 2959 is what we're talking about, but we don't have it in our possession, so we're not actually going to move it, but we wanted to have the RFA presentation. So we all remember that this is something that's a priority for us, and we'd like to see that happen. So thank you for coming today to provide the information, and I think we will move on to the next bill.
Thank you.
Oh, yes, sorry. We have a couple of people here to testify in support of this, so we need to make sure that we get them down. So we have Josie Linetti from the Farm Bureau, and I think Stu Laurie is here from Farmers Union. And so I apologize that I didn't have you. So please go ahead and state your name.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Josie Linetti with the Minnesota Farm Bureau. I'll be brief. We just want to echo our support for this bill and thank you for bringing it to the Ag Committee so that we could take the time to hear our presentation on RFA and the importance of this program. You know, the way we look at it, it's another tool that we could provide in the toolbox for farmers and those in agriculture. I know that's a saying we say a lot here at the Capitol, but it's true. As we continue to experience the financial and emotional challenges, continuing to have those tools available, especially when there's such demand for the program, we certainly support continued funding of it, and thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you for that. Mr. Lurie.
Thank you, Chair Poppy and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stu Lurie. I'm the Government Relations Director for Minnesota Farmers Union. It's good to be here up here with Josie talking about what was really an exceptional program in Minnesota. And, you know, I think as members of the committee, you often hear Commissioner Peterson and his team talk about the challenges and opportunities in agriculture and you know, whether that's rebuilding after disasters, investing in marketing a new crop or taking advantage of a new opportunity or a farm transition, kind of right at the center of making that successful for a farm family is affordable financing, right? And we have this really incredible program here in Minnesota and need to see it funded early in session. You know, I was briefly calling a couple folks this morning because I understood that we might have this opportunity today and talk to two of our members. You know, one family, they farm in Blue Earth County. They've been renting some acres that their daughter farms on, and that landowner is going through a transition himself and has notified them that he's going to need to sell those acres. Mm-hmm. They're right now trying to figure out a financing plan for how they can buy those acres so that their daughter can continue to graze beef there and hopefully, you know, leverage that land at some point to buy the entire farm. They're looking at this in the coming months. Like, the difference between getting this to the floor now and in May could be the difference between, you know, that family getting that land and in the end taking over that operation. So I think that's not a unique story, and I'm hopeful that we can bring it to the floor for the sake of those the folks who are kind of in those transition points and would hope to rely on the program. And again, this was alluded to, but there is precedent for passing it early. I believe, Representative Miller, you actually carried the bill in 2017 that got passed. I believe the effective date was even February 18th. So it's kind of fitting that we're talking about that today. But very hopeful stand in support of getting this to the floor and funded early so that they can start making good on their loans to farmers, folks who are trying to reinvest in their operation and young farmers across the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Linetti and Mr. Lurie. And I apologize again that I didn't have you come up. So that great testimony is absolutely what we needed for the cherry on top of the cake. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
So now we'll move on to Representative Vang. Again, this is an informational hearing on House File 3309. And along with that, we will have hear from Mr. Horvath, who's the MDA lab director. We've been we've toured the lab, so we know kind of what the layout is. Last year we did that, and I know we've done that previously and with other committee chairs. So we are happy to, again, talk about funding the Department of Ag's lab. So welcome to the committee, and Representative Vang, if you have any introductory comments.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Today I'm presenting House File 3309. This bill will authorize the state to sell about $20 million in bonds and appropriate the proceeds to the Department of Administration to renovate and improve the laboratory building used by the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health. It will also appropriate approximately $800,000 from the general fund to move and recalibrate scientific equipment. And I'll leave the rest to our presenter, Gary, who will talk a little bit more about the
process. Thank you, Mr. Horvath. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Poppy and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gary Horvath. I'm the lab director at the Department of Agriculture. And unfortunately, we sent over the wrong PowerPoint, so I'm going to do without, if that's okay by you. So basically, we're here for the bonding of the laboratory. The laboratory building serves the mission of both our agency, the Department of Ag, and also the Department of Health, Public Health Lab. We ensure safe food supply, looking for pesticide residues, foodborne pathogens, environmental contaminants. Health is looking for infectious disease like Ebola, Zika, measles, and of course, if you read the news, the coronavirus or whatever it's called now, I can't recall. But we protect drinking water, hazardous chemicals, radioactive testing, just a wide array of testing goes on between both agencies in this building. And so basically, the building back in 2014, we had a catastrophic event. We had at the time, since we moved in about 2005, we had an extraordinary first real cold snap.
Just to interrupt once, so even the information we have in the packet.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't know what happened. This is our third year seeking these funds, and I think the wrong file went over because I updated it and shortened it. So I apologize. I can certainly get that to you, but so you just have to bear with me, unfortunately. So back in 2014, the lab had a catastrophic event because of an unprecedented cold snap, or at least the first one since we had moved in, and it's caused a failure of our heat wheels, which allowed super cold air to get down onto the floors. They froze the devices that manage the heat at a finer level. Those coils froze. When the building thawed out, all of those opened up, and we had a massive flood. Raining down on office space and lab equipment, suffered a great deal of damage. And so subsequently after that, the Department of Admin decided to look at, the building was never commissioned originally because of cost concerns at the time. The budget was taxed and it just never got commissioned. So the Department of Admin undertook a retro commissioning to look at, well, what other things aren't right. And as a consequence, they focused on the mechanical system, utilities, electrical systems, and basically looking, is the building still meeting the missions of both agencies? They found a great deal of issues, deteriorated ductwork. We had rotting ductwork. One of the things that happened was value engineered out the stainless ductwork because the price of steel had gone up at the time and put in galvanized. Both agencies use a lot of acid and the ductwork was deteriorating. We had some hood exhaust insufficient in certain areas, and one of the real concerns we have is trouble controlling air pressure between rooms, and that's very concerning to staff, because if you're in one room and you're working with a very toxic or contagious item, if the pressure changes and is leaving the room, that's not a situation you want. You want it all going into the room and out through either a biosafety cabinet or a fume hood. So we found areas in the lab where the pressures weren't under control. We found lots of, we found some issues where systems had stopped working, maybe valves. It just, the building's a very complicated kind of a living thing. It's got a new, you affect something over here, it can change the pressures throughout. So it's a very sophisticated building, and found a lot of issues that needed addressing. So we had come before the legislature the last 2 years seeking bonding to make these repairs. We were not successful. Just recently, just finishing up now, the Department of Admin had to use CAPRA funds, $2 million, because we had some stuff that was so bad that they felt, for safety reasons, they had to fix. There was some really rotted ductwork in various parts of the chemistry section, and they had to work on some BSL, the biocontainment lab fans, And we're undergoing right now a rebalancing, trying to rebalance the system after we changed out a bunch of exhaust fans. And so the building needs some help. I think the main thing I want to get across here is the lab is really a safety device. If you work in the lab, the staff has the building, which is if functioning well, controls pressures, exhausting properly, filtering exhaust when necessary. And then the staff have other, you know, you have procedures, you have personal safety device, training, all of that. Well, the staff is, over these last few years, is getting more and more concerned as to the functionality and safety of the building. We have these pressures, people are fully aware of them. And you know, we're working with some nasty stuff in there, and this, and so we really want to emphasize that this building needs to function well and safely for our staff, and also so that people are confident when working on these important issues. So I think with that I will, oh yeah, the other thing is I'm sorry, so the ask is for $21,278,000. The design for the work is 85% complete. There is a vendor on board that has been working on these repairs I just mentioned, and we're hopeful that if we get funded, we can start work in 2020. So I guess with that, I'll take any questions you might have.
All right. Thank you for that presentation, Mr. Horvath. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, kind of eye-popping numbers here. I have a couple questions, because we had a similar situation a few years ago with the Science Museum with contracts, that on a very recent building there were issues with the contractor, and I'm wondering what if the department had pursued any. So the 2014 incident is within 10 years of the completion of the building. Was there any effort on going back on, for lack of a better term, the warranty on the building or the contract maintenance? That's the question.
Okay. Mr.
Chair, Representative Hansen, I have Chris Given here, or Wayne Wozlowski from admin, to answer those types of questions.
All right, the call of friend. Okay, welcome to the committee, and please state your name.
Certainly. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Wayne Wozlowski. I'm the Director for Real Estate and Construction Services within the Department of Administration.
Thank you.
By the time we understood the full extent of the repairs, the incident, the water incident, was in 2014, and that's when we, after that was occurred, that's when the retro commissioning study was done. By the time we understood the full extent of all the issues, we were into 2016, so we were past the statute of limitations. But I would also say, when we look back at the record, there's nothing apparent that says that this wasn't constructed as designed. I think Director Horvath alluded to one significant factor that we have to consider. We know, for example, the ductwork was a value engineering decision. What other value engineering decisions were made at the time to fit within the project budget? So it isn't as simple to say that it's readily apparent that this was the fault of a contractor or a design firm. I think the project budget certainly could have played a significant role in this situation.
Representative Hans.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And two questions. So if the bones aren't good, what can you fix this? If the building structure, I mean, how do we have an assurance that investing here on these fixes will actually fix the problem, or are we going to be back here in 10 years and find out that the actual structure of the building is off? Let's just say off.
Madam Chair, yes. Representative, the structure of the building itself is perfectly fine. Really what we're talking about is how the building breathes, how it brings in air, how it manages that building pressure, and how it exhausts air as one of the fundamental things. There's several other components to this project, but there's a few things that we have going. It starts with getting the right team in place. So we did make sure that through a competitive process that we selected the highest qualified firm with the expertise with laboratory facilities, so we have the right expertise that is involved in designing the facility. There's also technology has changed. So going from our valve control system, we can now have a more automated system on our valve controls with current technology. So there's some upgrades from what was available in 2005. And then it's the things you know about. It's the using, instead of galvanized steel, we're using the stainless steel ductwork that we know will has a track record of performing in these situations. So it's a combination of making sure we have the right expertise involved, but then also looking at what's the best technology available today to deal with these really sophisticated operations that happen in a facility like this.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is my final question. This was, to my knowledge, a rent-to-own building. And have we moved from renting to owning, or are we, how much debt from construction is still existing on this building?
Mr. Wesolowski.
Madam Chair, Representative, this actually was a GEO bond finance part. The lab building was GEO bond, state-funded project, so it was a state-owned facility. I'd have to get back to, we'd have to look up to see what the remaining, any debt remaining on that, but we'd be very close to having that debt fully retired for the work for the original construction. The Freeman building, the office building next door, was the where we had the Port Authority financing that was involved.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Horvath, some of the things you said were a little bit alarming or concerning. You know, if you're working on some, as you say, nasty things and bacteria, pathogens, things like that, I would hope they would be well contained and not have to rely on making sure you get the door shut to keep these things from spreading throughout the building. How secure are some of these things?
Madam Chair, Representative, well, maybe I'm being, you know, dramatic, but it's a real concern when you see and people know that pressures change. The staff working there feel you know, have faith in each other's professionalism and ability to know when something is of a concern. We do have some things that help us identify when issues aren't working. It's not a rampant issue. It's just enough to make you question it. And I believe the building currently is safe. But again, things go into alarm. People occasionally have to stop and, you know, get someone. We need to maybe address it. We can't let it get to that point where people feel it's unsafe. We're not there yet, but it is something I, as the director who have people that I'm responsible for and want to keep safe, that I think about. And, you know, part of what we've been telling them is, well, you know, the big fix when we get all these valves on the new technology that that Wayne has said is out there will give us that, you know, added level of control. And, you know, I hate keep saying that because you know all of you folks here have tough decisions, but this is a critical piece of the public safety infrastructure for the state, and it needs some help, and I just hope that you can find your way to support it.
Okay, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess my question is, do we have any assurance that this will correct the problem, or would we be better off taking this $20 million and putting it towards a brand new facility?
Mr. Horvath or Mr. Wesolowski?
Go ahead, yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, I would just start with the actual structure. There's a lot that's working well with the building, the roofing systems, the window systems, the building exterior. There's a lot of infrastructure that's bought and paid for that's useful going forward, a lot of electrical infrastructure. Really, we're getting, it's mainly around the HVAC system and we're going to put in, and we're able to put in, again, the latest technology around that. So we think once it's completed, you're going to have, again, a state-of-the-art laboratory facility, as Director Horvath indicated, that it's obviously critical testing that they do related to public safety and health. We obviously, you know, from a, even from the funds we allocated from the department, you know, we saw the importance of the facility to the state in allocating the $2 million in CAPR funds that we did this past year, and obviously are here wanting to support this this effort as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, the I will say that the lab staff has been invited to and has attended a lot of the discussions as to the work and to the solution, and we are confident that admin and the vendors understand the issue. So yes, I believe this work will alleviate the HVAC issues we have.
Thank you. Thank you. So Representative Vang, do you have any concluding comments?
Nope, thank you, Madam Chair, and members look forward to your support.
So this, again, was an informational hearing only. We don't take action on it. The bill will is in the possession of the Capital Investment Committee. So, but we will have one more bill that we are going to hear and act on.
Representative Poppy, please move your bill and begin.
Thank you. So this is a bill that is in our possession, House File 3296. I'd move that it be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Capital Investment Finance. And so this is a bill to help fund the veterinary diagnostic lab, so the VDL. And I've got David Preisler here. He's going to speak to the need for this and the urgency, really, about it. So that's what we're here to talk about.
Mr. Preisler, please state your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Preisler. I'm the CEO for the Minnesota Pork Producers Association, and we're located down in Mankato. First of all, I want to thank Madam Chair for authoring this bill, House File 3296, and we are wholeheartedly in support of this. Little background: one of the things that, quite honestly, we are—I don't know if "scared" is the right word, but it probably is—of what the possible impact of foreign animal disease could be if it came to the U.S. Specifically, African swine fever, but we also can't ignore foot and mouth disease and other diseases that are out there that can affect multiple species. And so one of the things that we've done in reaction to that is established here in the state an emergency disease council, and we've worked actively with farms, our association, the Board of Animal Health, the DNR, MPCA, the Department of Ag, and University of Minnesota to really look at preparedness and also to do exercises around that. First and foremost, though, we want to look at excluding the disease, and working with our federal partners with that. There was just a bipartisan bill that passed both the Senate and the House to look at and is awaiting signature by the President to hire more folks at our borders to do border inspections. So whether it's at airports, whether it's at the border crossings. And so we're really pleased with that, because again, first and foremost, we want to keep anything from getting here. But if it got here, we need to have a response. And so that's what we've been actively planning on. How that relates to this bill is that we have an excellent diagnostic lab here at the University of Minnesota, one of the better ones in the country. What this bill does is make it even better. And the request financially here is for $675,000. $600,000 of that would be for equipment, and $75,000 would be for software and programming to interface with that equipment into their information system. And in the essence of time, really what the equipment does is to bring more automation to testing. And so to really handle a surge of testing. So one of the things that, as our group has met, one of the things we've identified is, you know, if we did have a disease that showed up here, we would have to run multiple tests. And in order to move animals, in order to prove that we may have either negative animals or positive animals, in order for movement too. And that surge capacity probably does not exist in the United States in order to still have calmness occur and in order to make sure that we're doing the absolute right thing. There are a couple of labs in North America that have the equipment that is being requested here, but there's only two. And one of them's in Canada, okay? And so what we're looking at here, we're gonna be adding that equipment. Really what it does from a benefit standpoint is it would, from a surge capacity standpoint, multiply the amount of tests that could go through there by 2.5 times compared to what we have today, okay? Which it's more than significant. The other thing is it would result in probably about a 30% reduction in sample handling time and a 50% reduction in potential sample loading errors. So really this involves robotics as we look at liquid handling and just automation of procedures in order to just plain run more tests and have more testing capacity. I think we learned from avian influenza that the capacity of the lab was tested. And strained. And so as we look at this new equipment, we would look at this as really a hedge on the future. And again, to continue to be able to support a fantastic resource in that lab that in turn supports commerce here in the state from a standpoint of our entire livestock sector. This would not only be for African swine fever, would work for a whole host of diseases, foot and mouth disease, for example, classical swine fever. So it's not specific just of African swine fever. With that, I will try and stand for any questions and, again, appreciate the support for this bill.
Before we have any questions, does anybody else want to testify about this particular bill? Okay, we'll go to questions. Any questions? Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Chair Poppe, thank you for bringing this forward. I'm very much in support of it. My question is, what's the University of Minnesota's position on this? Do they support this request?
That's a great question. And I'm not sure that we're going to bring anyone up for the University of Minnesota. I think unless they jump up from their seats, I don't see that. You know, one of the issues that sometimes we have is, speak fairly frankly, you know, the university has their bonding requests and they have their priorities and categories of what they do and what they look at. I think that this should be at the top of that list. I'm not sure that it is currently. It's because they've gone through this process. So we are pursuing this because we understand the need. And we understand that the university will be maybe just sitting on the sidelines for a while on this issue, but that's why it's before us today to get us to the Capital Investment Committee so we can, again, David Preisler give us great testimony about the need and the urgency, and we'd like to be able to see it beyond their list, but certainly beyond the capital investment.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Chair Poppe, for being persistent. And I think I know the answer to my question. To the members, our friends from the University of Minnesota who are here today, please take it back to the Board of Regents and to the President that they better get on board. You're a land-grant university, and agriculture is critical to this state. And it is, I believe it's shameful for not taking a strong position. Emergent diseases are the number one threat, whether we're crops, flocks, or livestock. And it's absolutely critical that our university is prepared to deal with such. So again, please take that message back. Mr. Chairman, Chair Poppe, I believe that this is cash. Are we gonna be asking for a supplemental budget for Or will this be cash in the bonding bill?
Great question. Thank you, Representative Hamilton. And we are asking for cash in the bonding bill. We'll ask for anything, anywhere, to get this. I mean, I really do think that this is, you know, I represent a lot of pork producers, you know, a pretty strong pork area myself. And so it's very critical for us and for, and I think the state of Minnesota to act on this. So, but it is, this bill is kind of designed to be cash. If it were to be bonded, that's fine as well, but it's to get the money out of capital investment.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Lewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe to Mr. Chrysler, could you provide us with just a little bit of a summary of the kind of things Minnesota or our Midwest would face if we did have a outbreak of hoof and mouth disease, for example? I mean, I participated at the county level years ago doing those analysis on how to respond, and I'm not sure if you haven't worked in that area, you have a concept of what that would do to literally commerce in Minnesota, but maybe you could provide just a little insight for those that haven't had any experience in that area.
Mr. Chrysler?
My pleasure. Couple of things. One is that if you end up with a, it's not a long list, but there's a list of what are called foreign animal diseases, that if a country is positive for those diseases, you cannot export, right? And that's really where you get brought down to your knees. And why that's important is if we look at just the pork industry, for example, in December, and that's the latest month that we have data for, we exported a third of all the pork that was produced in the United States, okay? And so if we had a foreign animal disease that came to our shores, at least for a short period of time, and that would be the hope, is that it would be short, that number would probably go to zero, okay? Which would probably bring pig prices to about zero, and the impact that has not only on pork producers, but also corn and soybean producers, because they're purchasing feed from them, would be nothing short of catastrophic. Foot and mouth disease would probably be the worst because it affects multiple species. So any cloven hoof animal. So you'd have not only pigs, but sheep, goats, dairy cattle, beef cattle, deer. So any cloven hoof animal is susceptible to that disease. And it's also a disease that is highly contagious. Okay? It actually can be airborne, and so it is especially tough to deal with. And so the economic impact or negative economic impact would be in the billions, and that's just to Minnesota. That would not account for what would end up happening, across the country. So. And that is why we are so serious about these diseases, because we know what the economic risk is and why we invest time and energy into keeping them out, first and foremost, and then having plans put together to where, just in case it happens, we're in a position to do the best job and quickest job that we can to stamp it out right away to then get back to continuity of business.
Mm-hmm. Representative Cleveland.
Thank you, Chair Brand. I would like to say I think this is a very important topic that you're raising today, and Chair Poppe, I appreciate you bringing the bill forward. But I think it's also to Representative Hamilton's comment about the University of Minnesota. When we expect to have rapid response to major disease problems in any herd in our state, it is important that we do our preparation early. As a new member of the legislature who serves both on this committee and in higher education, what I have been surprised by as a new member is the idea that we will have just-in-time funding for the university, just-in-time funding for a crisis. And I think it's important that we be far-sighted in these endeavors. And in looking through the funding that the University of Minnesota has received in great detail this past year, to see the cuts in the budget, the cuts in the budget, the cuts in the budget that keep the university from being prepared for cases such as this is short-sighted. And I think your request is very prudent. And I think it's something that we have to be more proactive in as our economies get tighter and tighter and herds move from place to place and as we become a larger and global economy. So I do support this effort, but I want to say we cannot continue to cut institutions that prepare us for these situations and then blame them for not being prepared or blame them for not having the money to do the work that we need them to do. Thank you.
Any other questions for the testifier? Representative Hansen, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Priestler. I appreciate the concern on the foreign animal diseases, but I read something recently about that chronic wasting disease could be transmitted to swine. And wondering if you have any that's not a foreign animal disease, it's here now. If the swine industry has looked at that at all, or if you've been picking up any information on that.
Mr. Priestler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I have not seen that. One of the things where pigs are kind of unique up to this point is that there are no prion diseases that we're aware of that actually infect pigs. Okay, so I can certainly take a look at that, but again, there are not prion diseases that pigs have had. Again, we can certainly take a look at it. Thank you.
Representative Patterson, go ahead.
Just a quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Priestler, talking about disease is kind of a not a pleasant subject I used to talk about, but you mentioned the African swine fever, and it's destroyed about half of China's hog herd. And I was at a meeting, I think, of the vets here in the state, and they talked about the only place secure enough to do research in this country on that was it Kansas or Kansas State. Is that true? Is there actually work being done here in this country trying to find a vaccine for that African swine fever?
Mr. Priestler?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are really two places in the U.S. where the actual live virus can be worked with. Okay, one's in Plum Island, which is an island that's just off of New York, and that's a lab that's been there a long, long time that's really on its way out. Okay, and then that will be really replaced by a lab that is gearing up and is active right now in Kansas, so adjacent to Kansas State University. That is it. Okay. As far as developing a vaccine, there has been attempts numerous times in numerous different countries, and it's still going on today, to develop a vaccine that would work. I'm not a veterinarian, but my understanding is that it's a very large, complex virus. And just because you have a virus, whether it's in human medicine or in animals, doesn't mean you can create a vaccine for it. And so this is one that's very difficult to make a vaccine for because it has a number of different proteins on it. And to be able to actually locate and then be able to the right proteins and then to create an immune response with a vaccine is really, really hard. And there's just not a better description for it. It's not, I don't think, for lack of trying, and I think especially in Asia and parts of Eastern Europe, the economic value of trying to find a vaccine is immense. So there are significant resources going towards it, because just like you said, I mean, half of the swine herd in China has been, you know, either killed by it or was harvested early to avoid it. And to put that in perspective, prior to that, half of the world's pigs were in China, okay? So if you think about that, a quarter of the world's pigs vanished. It's something that we take very seriously.
I've got two more people that wish to to ask questions, and then we'll wrap this up. Representative Tabke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say really quickly thank you to
Chair Poppe and Mr. Priestler for this work, no matter where and how the money comes forward. This is a issue that we're all continuing to learn about and understand as to, especially the foreign diseases as they're coming in, and we need to have this plus more support for our farmers being done in the state of Minnesota. So thank you very much for that work.
And Representative Hamilton, did I see your hand? Okay, that's it then. Seeing no further discussion, Chair Poppe, would you like to...
I renew my motion that House File 3296 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Capital Investment Finance.
All right. The Poppe motion is before us. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the bill is on the way to bonding committee.
Yes, thank you.
Representative Keel, you would like to ask a question.
Thank you, Chair Brand. I just wanted to point out that some of our sugar growers were here. They were in and out. So, and no, that's fine. They're busy trying to meet with members, so... But I'm going to take a little liberty. One of the gentlemen is my son.
Oh, hey.
He's hiding right now. No, our son Christian, who is our fourth generation farmer on our farm. So,
can I ask a question? Representative Keel, is Christian the entrepreneur? Is he the inventor?
Yes.
Yes, with a patent. Is that correct? Congratulations. Thank you.
Representative Poppe, is there anything else you'd like to...
No, we'll plan to see people probably either at Farm Bureau or at Sugar Beets or at Milk, you know, somewhere this afternoon. Hopefully everybody has a safe afternoon, and we'll see you there. And thank you again to Minnesota Milk for providing the tweets today.
You bet. Next meeting is this Thursday, the 20th of February. Meeting adjourned.